Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
Kids that were into what would later become hip hop at that time were so devotional, it was freaky.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 208, a talk with Tom Silverman. Tom is the Tommy in Tommy Boy Records. He founded the label in 1981. After several early hip-hop and dance singles, the label found success with Planet Rock. But it was in hip-hop's golden age of the late 1980s and early 90s that Tommy Boy would really blow up, signing acts like Queen Latifah, Digital Underground, House of Pain, Coolio, Naughty by Nature, and De La Soul. Silverman also founded the New Music Seminar, the influential and long-running music conference whose annual rap and DJ battles would become the stuff of legend. We talked to Tom Silverman at the Tommy Boy offices in Manhattan. If you like the show, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. It helps us fill our sex packets, and we've recently updated our rewards with some crazy new stuff. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cypher. And now, here's the man who brought Planet Rock to the world and helped forever change the sound of planet Earth, Tom Silverman.
We have had Monica Lynch on the show last fall.
Good.
So she said that you definitely have sex packets.
Sex packets, a dollar or two. Just tell me how many for you this time. This time. This time.
So do you still have sex packets?
The physical sex packets,
yeah.
I don't know if I do have them. They're in storage somewhere. I don't know. I have most of the Tommy Boy gear. And I think I have a condom hat from Digital Underground, but I'm not sure if I have.
Wait, a condom hat?
Yeah, what? We did that. We did a condom hat for something. I don't know if that was part of the sex packets campaign. There were hats that were shaped like condoms made out of rubber that had a promotional thing on them. We had quite a lot of tchotchkes for Digital Underground. Really, you know, was open to a lot of things, and their music sort of gave us a lot of ways to market with.
Yeah, but I wanted to take it back to you, because you don't often talk that much about your sort of very pre-Tommy Boy history. So you were in grad school when you started Disco News. Going into that, what was your history?
No, I left
music?
Grad school to start Disco News.
Oh, so take me through that. That's kind of a big decision.
Yeah, I was in grad school for environmental geology, and I was finishing my master's thesis, and I finished all my orals, and I had sent out 200 resumes looking for jobs in water quality at the time, and got two interviews and no job offers. And in the same time when I was getting rejected, rejection, I guess, is really the thing that's driven me all my life. And when I was getting rejected by people in the water quality space, consulting firms, I was looking in the private sector. I got a letter from my old college roommate who ran the radio station with me. He was the station manager. I was the music director up in Maine at Colby College. Mm-hmm. And he had taken a job in LA at Cashbox, which was the trade publication along with Billboard and Record World. There used to be three big ones, and he was doing the R&B charts. And it was in the years that disco was ready to explode. I think Saturday Night Fever had just come out and everybody was going disco crazy. And he suggested that we move to New York and start a tip sheet for DJs. Nobody had ever had that idea. There were tip sheets for radio guys, and the people who were doing them were making a lot of money mm-hmm. in the radio business. So we thought it could be really great. So that I got excited, and it was exactly the right time because I'd just been rejected. And I said, what the fuck? I had a risky business moment. And I left Kalamazoo and came to New York and took an apartment in the city. He was supposed to follow later from LA, and we're setting up Disco News, the newsletter for DJs that we talked about.
Wow. And so how'd your family react when you said, hey, you know, this science thing I've been studying since undergrad, you know, forget about it?
They were so cool. I mean, I told them what was going on, and then they actually lent me $5,000 to start the newsletter. And I think Scott Anderson, who was my partner who came in from Cashbox to start the newsletter with me, put in $5,000. So I think we put in $10,000, or maybe it was $2,500 each. But we had like no money, and you know, we had to figure out how to do all this, and we had no business experience either. So I went to NYU at night and took a class in return on investment, and I started taking meetings with the record companies that had disco product at the time, and I had met with them and told them what we were getting to do, and we kind of announced this new thing. And we got support with advertising for some of them, but at very low prices. And we started out as a weekly, running out of our, we worked out of our bedroom. Mm-hmm. We had a two-bedroom apartment, and we worked out of the living room. And then we brought in a guy who went to Colby also to work with us too. So there were three of us that were really running it and living there. So it was kind of a circus. We lived and worked in the same place and did everything, you know, from selling the ads to writing the article to, you know, setting the type.
Where did you physically print it?
We printed it at a newsletter house. They used to have such a thing, which would print, you know, photo offset place that would do big jobs, and it was folded and stapled. Or first it was just folded, and then eventually it was folded and stapled by this newsletter house. And we have to do the layout ourselves, and we used the IBM Selectric typewriter, and we changed the balls to change the type, you know, the type balls. And that was how we started. And then the headlines we did, we'd go to an offset place and have them make little a typography place. They do the headlines, and we'd stick them on with wax. We'd wax them down and burnish them on, and then we'd bring them to the place. And then they would do the make ready, and they'd show us, and we'd see if there was any mistakes, and then they'd print, and then we'd sort of have to go back down to the 20s, West 20s, where the print place was, and we were up on 91st and 3rd in Yorkville Towers in one of the apartments there. And then when everything was ready, we'd have to pick up the boxes of magazines, bring them back to the bedroom, mm-hmm. and start putting the stickers on them with all of the addresses, and bring them to the post office. And then we also would sell them in record stores. We'd sell them in the record stores all the DJs went to. We'd have a little stand up and DJs would buy them there.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the old consignment model. Yeah.
All the charts, all the calls we'd have to make to DJs, to record pools, to record stores, and to radio stations. Every week, we'd build charts in each of
you
the different areas.
You do your own charts?
Yeah, we did our own charts in multiple different areas. We had an overall chart that was done from DJs and from the combination of the other sources that we had. We also wrote about imports, and we came up with the BPMs, the beats per minute on the top. We had our chart was the top 80, and we published the beats per minute of all the top 80 records that were being played in the clubs.
That's an actual practical thing for DJs.
In those days, they couldn't beat match without that. There was actually a company that advertised with us called Disco Bible from up near Albany, and this guy named Tom Lewis would publish this giant printout that he'd send out once a month with all of the disco records and their beats per minute. And that was the only reason people used it. And then they'd write the number on the record.
Wow.
That's why in all of the early Tommy Boy records, the beats per minute were actually on the label, because we knew that's something that DJs wanted.
Sure. So at some point, disco starts to become cliche, fall out of favor, however you want to say it, as
the
a
name.
Word. Yeah, as a word, not as a style necessarily. And you change the name to Dance Music Report.
Yeah, we felt that disco was the place where the dance music was played. We never considered it a kind of music, mm-hmm. but we changed the name to Dance Music Report, which was probably a much better name anyway. We remarked that in the year that they were blowing up disco records and everyone was blaming the crash in the music business in 1979 on disco, at the end of the year, like six of the top 10 records of the year were what would have been considered disco records in the past.
Right.
Tom, by our count, it's seven.
It's fun to stay at the YMCA. It's fun to stay at the
hot stuff, baby, this evening. I need some hot stuff, baby, tonight. I want to go and ring my bell. You can ring my bell.
So tell me about the transition from that into putting out records yourself. It wasn't you wake up one day and all of a sudden I'm going to start a label.
Well, you don't make a lot of money doing it. You know, we thought we would do a lot better running a tip sheet than we did. After we started a lot of different things. I started a typesetting company, a PR company. I became a serial entrepreneur. In 1980, we started the New Music Seminar with another publication called Rockpool that had a record pool for rock DJs.
Right.
And we had pioneered a section of Dance Music Report that was called DOR, Dance Oriented Rock. And we actually trademarked the name DOR because we were the first people to identify that there was this burgeoning group of DJs that played rock music and kids liked to dance to rock music too. But we considered, you know, we covered reggae, we covered every kind of music people dance to, Latin, beach music, any kind of music from around the world that we identified that was happening in North America that people were dancing to. You know, we identified Euro disco as one thing. You know, there was a, you know, a gay kind of a disco sound, and then there was a white straight sound, there was a black gay sound that was different than the white gay sound, and you know, and we covered all of it. We'd be, you know, at all the clubs. We'd go down to the, mostly to the gay clubs because they were so dominant, but especially Larry Levan at Paradise Garage, and
right,
you know, hear what was happening there and follow radio and just try to identify trends. And we got involved with the early remixers, and we covered, and we always put all the data in about who remixed and which versions people should look for. So we gave a lot of really important information in a world without an internet, without cell phones at all.
Yeah.
Early days of fax machines, you know, and people really, really were hungry for this information. At one point we were printing 5,000 of these things, and we had a circulation of around 4,500 between record stores. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a bit of people who are DJs. You know, at the time we probably thought there were about 10,000 to 15,000 DJs in North America. Now there's probably 15,000 DJs within a five block.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. And so at some point you become aware that people are taking what at that point were contemporary records and playing only parts of it, or sometimes older records, and, you know, using these things called breaks.
Yeah. Well, I wrote an article in Dance Music Report, and I need to go find that article. I think it was in 1980. I got tipped. One of the reporters to us was a record store called Downstairs Records, and we called them, and they were one of the big disco stores in the late 70s. And I don't know if it was 79 or 80, maybe it was 79. I can't remember. They started an adjunct store right next to their store. It was the size of this room, tiny little like a closet with a shelf, and the records were behind the shelf, and people would line up outside. And this was in Downstairs Records, which was 43rd Street in the mezzanine on the way into the subway. I went down to check it out, and there was a long line of kids waiting to buy records. And there was the guy behind. I went behind the counter. I looked at all the records, and I go, wow, there's Herman Kelly in Life, Dance to the German's Beat. There's Apache 45, obviously a bootleg. There's the Eagles' The Long Run album. There's a Billy Squire 12-inch DJ version on Big Beat.
Big Beat, right.
All of these records, what do they have? Kraftwerk record. I say, what are all these records have to do? And why are all these 16-year-old black kids waiting online to buy records? They'd pooled their money and they were buying two copies of everything. And they said, this is what's happening now. This is called the break room. I asked one of the kids online, how do you know what to buy? And they said, well, we buy what Afrika Bambaataa plays. And I said, wow, who's Afrika Bambaataa? And the guy who worked there knew Bambaataa was and would go up there and, you know, he would find the records that he could identify that Bambaataa would play, because at the time, the few DJs that would find records in the Bronx would steam the labels off or hide them and cover them so people wouldn't know what they were playing, so that they would be the only one who had it for as long as possible.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's at the point that I got his phone number, I called him and I asked if I could come up and hear him. And I went to hear him at the T Connection, and I saw what was happening, where he would play all of these records that I saw on the walls, you know, from Sly and James Brown and George Clinton mixed with, you know, the Monkees. Or Billy Squire or Cerrone. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, I know these records, but I never thought that this part would go with that. There were no white people, and there was nobody over 17 or 18 in the club, it didn't seem. I was blown away. And when I first went up there, it was up at the top of the stairs where Bambaataa was spinning in the balcony. And on one side, it was Jazzy J, and the other side, it was Red Alert.
Wow.
And they would take turns spinning. And, you know, I saw the records that had little ink marks on the labels and some that were steamed off. And, you know, there was all kinds of hieroglyphics. And Afrika Bambaataa gave me his card, and it said, Afrika Bambaataa, Master of Records.
It's quite a title. Yeah. although accurate at that point, definitely.
And to this day, yes.
Yeah, still. So how does Arthur Baker come into all this and get connected?
He doesn't come for many years.
Oh,
so
okay.
So I asked Ben Body, do you want to make a record that sounds like this, what you're playing? And he said yes. So that was the beginning of Tommy Boy.
And I guess 1980. That's the thing that I'm curious about, because although there were hip hop records at this time, the idea of taking a live experience and putting it on a record, not that many people would think of it. It's like taking a stoplight and putting it on record. How did you kind of come up with that idea of, I'm going to make a discrete record of this whole evening?
It wouldn't be the whole evening, but the elements of using the old records you're playing and recontextualizing to make something new. Let's figure out if there's a way we could do that. I was at the time, I was having trouble. So my partner had left. I was running Dance Music Report myself. We had a big debt. I was trying to pay the debt off by doing it all on my own. I was slowly paying the debt off, but I was pretty depressed. I wanted to start this label. We had run the first New Music Seminar and it lost money. It was some kind of a problem. I forget what it was. We did a one-day conference at the SIR rehearsal studios, and we had a couple hundred people, and it was a, let's call it a critical success, but a fiscal disaster. Mm-hmm. And my partner was more involved in that than I was at the time. And then there was two partners in the rock pool, Mark Josephson and Danny Heaps, and it was more Scott Anderson and Danny Heaps that ran the first one. And both of them, after the experience of the first one, checked out and didn't want to be involved. So Mark and I took over after that. But I got sick, really sick. I was in a state of kind of depression. I skipped graduate school. I wondered if I'd done the right thing. It's not too late for me to turn in my master's thesis and maybe get my degree still. I'm almost ready to throw in the towel.
Right.
I go up to my parents' house, who live in White Plains, New York, in the suburb. I nurse myself back to health. I go to a music store that I know in White Plains called Sam Ash, and talk to the guy who runs the synthesizer department and tell him my idea of doing this electronic record in a studio, and could he come with some instruments and, like, let's do something, a demo for a record. And so we went to Mamaroneck, New York, which is adjacent to White Plains, and went to a studio called In the Red and recorded an 8-track demo of what would become Planet Rock. Bambada came,
mm-hmm.
and this is when I was sort of home in bed recuperating, and we cut the demo of Planet Rock, and it had 4 songs in it that could be deemed to be samples, at least in the demo. They're all replays,
mm-hmm.
But played by this guy who was like a rock guy with long hair.
That you just found at the music store.
Yeah, that, and he had a lot of instruments, so he brought stuff down, and we made something that sounded really electro, because Bambada was into sort of that Kraftwerk electro set. And we went in that direction, and we recorded this demo, and some 3 or 4 months later, I played a cassette of the demo for Arthur Baker, and he loved it, and he said, let's do that record. It wasn't until a year after that that I did it with him, but before that, I did another record with Bambada, Jazzy Sensation,
right.
Which I did with Arthur first, and that one had actual musicians playing, you know, replaying Funky Sensation.
Yeah, you had a couple early things Bambada related. There was the Cotton Candy. Did he bring that in?
Yep. He brought in Cotton Candy. He brought in the Johnson Crew.
Group Johnson Crew, consisting of brothers Michael, Sonny, and Maurice Johnson, along with several other members, released a number of singles on Tommy Boy between 1982 and 1985. You might know Maurice Johnson better by the stage name he took in 1980, Maurice Starr, a name that would become widely known when he discovered New Edition and New Kids on the Block.
Those two were the ones that he brought in. He might have brought in Rock the House, Pressure Drop. I'm not sure if that one came from him or not. There was a bunch of records in the early days, and we were still set up to do street music, and street music in those days was disco too, you know, so we would have considered, it wasn't called hip hop by the way yet.
You sure.
know, when I interviewed Bambada, he didn't call it hip hop, he called it breaks, and he said some people are calling it hip hop because it's the way people dance to it. He used to say, like, where one leg was shorter than the other, that's why they call it hip hop. He said, if you were dancing, you know, and he was funny. He was a great guy, and, you know, very nice. And I said, let's let's do it. I didn't realize he had already had a deal with Paul Winley with Afrika Bambaataa and the Cosmic Force at the time.
Say, what's the name of this nation? Zulu, Zulu. And who's gonna get on down? The Cosmic Force, the Cosmic Force. Check it out. Chitty, chitty, bang, bang.
Paul Winley was a songwriter and label owner whose label Winley Records put out some of the first breakbeat and rap records, including by his daughters Tanya and Paulette. Bambaataa and the Cosmic Force recorded Zulu Nation Throwdown for the label in 1980.
But when I was recording with him, Jazzy Sensation, I remember Robert Christgau came on his bicycle to the studio. We were doing a mix, Jelly Bean or something, at the Vanguard Studios on 23rd in the Chelsea Hotel.
Ah.
Robert Christgau is known as the Dean of American Rock Critics. He was at the Village Voice from 1974 until 2006. The Jelly Bean Tom mentions here is John Jelly Bean Benitez, who was at that point beginning to make a name for himself as a DJ, remixer, and editor by working on songs like Planet Rock and the Johnson Crew's Pack Jam. His star would rise considerably when he produced a few songs for the 1983 debut album of his girlfriend, a woman named Madonna.
Quite a collection of people in one room.
I'm telling you, well, he stopped in to see what was going on. He interviewed Bambaataa, took a few notes. He's very aloof because he was the god of music critics at the time, the American god. And whatever he wrote, you know, it was just him and one other New York Times guy probably, and maybe an LA Times guy. What if they wrote something, every other critic would follow. He was riding up to Harlem to interview Paul Winley, who evidently didn't show up for the interview. And here he is all the way up in Harlem, white guy on his bicycle trying to do the interview. I can only imagine what that was like. But, you know, so that was the beginning. That was 1981 when we were recording Jazzy Sensation. That was the first, and that was the beginning. And then we did more after that.
Wow.
And I also would go to see Bambaataa spin more regularly, not only at the Tea Connection, mm-hmm. but at the Bronx River Center when they'd have big throwdowns or Zulu Nation anniversary parties.
Wow. And there's a Curiosity record early in your collection, and I don't think it's even on Tommy Boy. You can tell me the history of this, but Let's Vote.
Yeah.
And what it means to me and you, so we can realize that to better our lives is a simple thing each one of us can do. Let's vote.
Let's vote.
Let's vote. You say it doesn't help. That's a bunch of jive for politics.
So that was a kind of a test run. I had two test runs before I started Tommy Boy. I wanted to make sure that I didn't piss away my own money.
Right.
So the first thing I did was I helped Mike Wilkinson start Import 12 Records. Mike Wilkinson was a guy who worked at an ad agency. He was a fairly successful guy in the ad business. He had the account for Mooney Aircraft, which is like a private, you know, like a single person or two person airplane, mm-hmm. pretty popular. And so he was making money compared to any of us. And I used to hang out with him a lot, and he wanted to start a label, and he started a label called Import 12, and I said, let me set your distribution up. So I used to come down 3 hours a day, get on the phone, cold call the distributors, make deals, learn how it all works, and I helped him set the company up. I didn't get paid, I just wanted the experience of it. But he was a big advertiser in Dance Music Report, so I was sort of getting paid.
Right.
And he had a thing called DiscoNet. DiscoNet was a monthly subscription service where each DJ that subscribed would get two albums filled with remixes of the current hits.
Mm.
They weren't really remixes because they didn't have the original 24 tracks. They were really re-edits by a couple of DJs that they paid, and he had this business on the side, and that's why he wanted to start Import 12. And I found some records for him, and we helped chase some records down, so I was involved with him on that for a while. So that set me up. And then before I started Tommy Boy, I wanted to put a record out, not on Tommy Boy, just to see what you have to do with distributors and pressing plants and all that stuff. So a guy brought me a record who had a label called Tryon Park, and so we put this record out on that label by Eric Neary called Let's Vote. It was a black voter registration theme song, did nothing, wasn't a hit, but so it was good it wasn't on Tommy Boy.
Right.
But I distributed it using the people, the relationships would eventually distribute Tommy Boy.
Mm-hmm.
It was my money, and it did cost me some money. I think I probably broke even or lost a few bucks on it. And then I did Cotton Candy was the first release, TB811, and that record broke even probably. That's where I had to borrow the $5,000 again from my parents to start this one, and I put it into that record, and I hired some people, and I used all my relationships at Dance Music Report, and I was able to get a bunch of play and sell about 5,000 units, which was enough to recoup my losses.
And keep everything going, yeah. So just random question that I was curious about looking at stuff the labels put out. Why start numbering at 811 as opposed to 001 or 100 or whatever?
It was the first release in 1981.
Ah.
81-1. Wow. 81-2, 81-3, 81-2 was a Jazzy Sensation.
Yeah.
And then the remix was 82-1, 821.
Wow.
So there's the secret of the early numbering of 12 inches on Tommy.
Makes sense. And
surprised you didn't figure that out.
Well, I know. Planet Rock comes out, obviously a giant hit, with like 600,000 100,000 sales. What did that do for you as a label owner?
It made me believe in God for the first time. Not as a label owner, just as a human. Because there's no real reason that anything like that should happen to anyone. Mm-hmm. You know, it's almost like normally you see bad things happen to people that make people sort of have a spiritual path. But this actually started me on a spiritual path because I saw this. It was like, wow, it's me and two other people in the office that are doing this. And we have no experience breaking records. You know, we've gotten very little airplay on anything. But, you know, here we are. And this record has got a life of its own. And it was just a matter of riding it like riding a wave.
Yeah.
And it was an unbelievable experience. And we had, I mean, Jazzy Sensation was a local hit. That did 35,000, paid my parents back. And I think before Planet Rock, was there anything that we had released that had done pretty well before that? No, I guess Planet Rock was the next big one. And then we had like a series of records that did pretty well.
Yeah. At what point did Mr. Magic, you're aware of him as a DJ, obviously, but at what point did he kind of start slipping you acts?
Well, I brought him Jazzy Sensation, and he's the first one to play that. And I really credit him with the one who broke Jazzy Sensation, because after he played that record once the following Monday, I got 5,000 orders for 5,000 12 inches, $398 list, which is like $10 today.
Yeah.
Or $9. It's really unbelievable. I mean, that
was his power back
then. That was the beginning. Well, that's true. And it was also Bambaataa's power, because he broadcasted from uptown and he got into the Bronx in northern Manhattan. It was only a 10,000 watt station. It was a tiny station in New York, and he only had a 2-hour radio show or something like that, or three.
Right. Only a couple hours a week. Yeah.
A week.
Good evening and welcome to the hottest music in the Apple. I once again welcome you and yours to the Mr. Magic Disco Showcase 1981.
Mr. Magic's Disco Showcase began airing in 1981 on WHBI, a public access station that charged broadcasters $75 an hour. As soon as there were enough hip-hop records to fill an entire show, the name changed to Mr. Magic's Rap Attack. In 1983, the program moved to WBLS.
Everyone tuned in. So it's unbelievable that a 10,000 watt, 2-hour a week show, which was on a radio station that didn't play hip hop.
Right.
You know, the station before was Talmud time, you know, and the time, you know, it was Hasidic Jews. And the one afterward was the other guys from Brooklyn, but also the deep reggae guys who you couldn't even understand what they were saying, was broadcasting to the Jamaican community in Brooklyn also.
Yeah.
And the Bronx. So it wasn't, they didn't share audiences. People just tuned in exactly.
Basically, everyone who listened to that show ended up buying the 12 inch pretty much.
Kids that were into what would later become hip hop at that time were so devotional. It was freaky. Mm. They would do anything. It was so crazy because it was such a new fad and it was addictive and they had to do anything. They were the ones lining up to buy those records. They'd do anything. And when you watch The Get Down on Netflix, you know, you think, wow, is this really true? And especially the first series, really, really is true. It was even more than that. Those kids, they would show up at anything with two turntables, music. People were really, really into it. And we're talking about really the prehistoric Stone Age of hip hop at that time.
Right.
But the passion for it was so intense, it's hard to explain to kids that are in hip hop today. You know, the people that are in hip hop today don't appreciate what the scenario was before. Imagine you're living in 1978 or 79 and Frankie Crocker is whatever it is WBLS and it's R&B, you know, M2ME, Juicy Fruit. Like that's as funky as it gets.
Right.
Occasionally there'll be a funk record that plays, but that's it. And all of a sudden, kids that don't get music lessons and don't have any way to make music, all of a sudden get turntables and can play records and make music that way. And kids who haven't had dance lessons make up dances and create. Everything's original.
Yeah.
Rapping, you know, breaking, you know, all of it. And then, you know, graffiti that had been brewing for a long time, you know, all of those writers started to become more and more artistic at the same time. And it all happened right at the same time within a 5-mile radius of one spot in the Bronx. You know, it's like the Bethlehem of music. It's unbelievable. It was the birthplace of an entire culture, four cultures, the four pillars really all happened in one place at one time. And the odds of that happening are so infinitesimal as to be virtually impossible.
Right.
It's beyond a miracle that hip hop exists. So that's what blossomed hip hop. And the question people always ask me is this a fad? And I didn't know how to answer that question, you know, because I'm just doing it.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. You're in the middle of it. You don't know, you can't look back from 40 years later and say, well, no, of course not. It's,
yeah.
You know, changed popular culture. You had no idea.
But I always treated it like it was, you know, mainstream.
Right.
Rock, I treated it with the same reverence that one would treat rock with, you know.
So Mr. Magic at some point starts bringing you acts, right?
Magic tipped me to Stetsasonic and the Force MDs.
Right.
But I had seen the Force MDs at a Zulu Nation party perform also.
Oh, okay.
I saw them do, he told them to call me, but I saw had seen them already, and they did the Gilligan's Island theme song with different words.
All TV shows make rap routines. Like back in the days, like rap routine, rap harmonizing routines with the DJ cutting the beat under there. So we took that idea from the past and just brought it up to the present.
Just sit right back and you hear a tale of the Force MDs and the day that we met the Fat Boys on the Staten Island Ferry. The Fat Boys.
Which blew my mind. And because they sang with harmony, they had steps, so they reminded me of a doo-wop group, and I'm a big doo-wop fan, which, by the way, also started in the Bronx mostly, you know, on the same streets, you know, which was a point that wasn't lost on me either. And I thought this would be great. So those two groups, yeah, that came out of that, and then one begets another, you know. Stetsasonic's DJ was Prince Ball, who booked De La Soul.
De La Soul, yeah. Yeah, so you have this sort of transition from the early years into, you know, what people kind of refer to as the golden age of hip-hop, maybe 86, 87 to like 91 or so. At what point did you realize that rap albums as opposed to 12 inches were going to be the primary artistic driver of the genre?
I never realized that. I think that they always were both. I think, in fact, when we started doing 12 inches, we had the choice at the time. 12 inches were, some of them were 45s and some were 33s.
Mm-hmm.
We chose 33, and I used my influence with the publication to get everybody to switch to 33, mm-hmm. because I felt that 33 is what albums were and 45s are what singles were, and we wanted to identify 12 inches with inexpensive albums as opposed to expensive singles. And so we pushed it for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then we started, and we were the first ones to move out of the hole in the center generic sleeve to full dress picture covers.
For 12 inches.
For 12 inches, yeah. Because I've always believed in branding and messaging, and, you know, with dance music and with street music at the time, your only place where you can make a statement to consumers is when it's up on the rack. You know, if you used to go into those old stores, every jacket was a generic jacket, and the guys that worked there would write on the record in big magic marker letters three or four words that would resonate with the audience because they knew what would sell the records. Sometimes they'd put a card on the record, but sometimes they'd write on the record, they'd say, you know, Pee-wee Dance or whatever, you know, whatever it is, and everybody would know what it was.
Get busy, y'all. Get busy.
It might not say the name of the artist or the title of the song,
right.
But it was what people were asking for.
Yeah.
The DJ, the guys that worked in the stores knew what people were asking for, and they really provided great service to them because they wanted to sell these records. It was just such a remarkable time.
Yeah.
It's not like that. I mean, there's no equivalent to that now.
Yeah. And you mentioned Stet. Daddy O is someone, he describes your relationship, the two of you, as kind of a frenemy over the years. Can you tell me a little bit about your relationship with Daddy O?
I love Daddy O. He was political, you know, he used to sort of dress and look like a little Malcolm X. He was very articulate, and he also had read Yogananda and some of the spiritual books that I was just getting into as I went through that whole revelation of having a record like that growing up atheist and having something like unexplainable like Planet Rock happen to me. And Bambaataa was also a person who was very much into spiritual looking. You know, he was a seeker. So we had a lot of conversations, and sometimes we agreed and we didn't agree. We used to record in our apartment. With the same apartment, we ended up putting a little recording studio in, and we actually recorded a lot of the Stetsasonic stuff in the apartment ourselves. We had a 24-track recorder and a big mixing board and two half-inch tape machine, and also a synclavier later that was like a digital synthesizer.
You fit all half dozen group members in the...
They would stay in the living room.
Okay.
And we'd run like one of these out into the other room, a DI box, and we'd have the mics in the living room. And then, you know, and then we'd mix in other places. I would show him all the stuff too, and his brother used to come in too, and I'd show him SoundScan in the early days, or I'd show him how reports were, and I'd teach him about the record business, because to me there was, you know, I was into transparency even then. This is what we're trying to accomplish. This is how, you know, he was smart and inquisitive, so I had no reason not to answer him, and I just showed him, look, this is what we're trying to do, and this is how we're trying to do it. We didn't always agree. He thought we should be able to force things. A lot of artists think labels can force stiffs to make them be hits, or records that are okay into records that are great. And, you know, I have seen it happen a few times, but it's very rare and it's very expensive and it's not what indies do.
Right. One of the things that made Tommy Boy so successful beyond its artists, or sort of the way the artists came in, was the staff. You know, obviously people we've had on the show before, people like, you know, Monica Lynch and Dante Ross and Paul Stewart. What were you looking for in a Tommy Boy employee in those mid-80s, or I guess in Monica's case, early 80s years, that those people came in?
What were we looking for? We thought we wanted people who were in the culture and who were motivated and hardworking and thought for themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. Same thing we're looking for today. But the culture was more clear because we were into something that was kind of revolutionary and underground at the time, so we needed people that could understand that, although that's not really true. You know, our bookkeeper, you know, accountant was Orthodox Jew, you know, and one of the second employee who was an office manager was a girl who really didn't know anything about music or any of the stuff. She just was somebody that answered the ad, but she was competent. And so, you know, we just needed people who didn't see it as a job, but really saw it as a lifestyle decision that we're going into this and we're going to give it 100%, which is different, you know, not somebody that checks in and checks out.
Right. Again, because we had her on and heard, you know, the early days from her perspective. What did you see in Monica when she answered the ad and started slinging heavy record crates into the back of your car or whatever?
She was the ultimate. I mean, that was, she answered an ad for Guy Gal Friday in the Village Voice, I think. And she came in and I said, okay, let's do this. And, you know, she seemed great. She had great energy. And the first day I think she worked, we had to put out Dance Music Report because she was working not just for Tommy Boy, it was also Dance Music Report. We did them all. And when there's an issue coming out, we have to work late. You know, we have to put the issue to bed. She worked 24 hours. And I believe it might even have been on her birthday. So, I mean, and so it showed the kind of dedication and how enthusiastic and excited she was,
right,
which meant a lot, you know, and she always treated it like it was her own business. And she, you know, she was fantastic. There's, you know, I mean, she's the standard that everybody has to be held to, which is impossible for anybody else.
Sure. And during the years that spun all the plaques that I'm looking at now, the De La Soul, Naughty by Nature, Diggable Planets, what were your day-to-day responsibilities? What would you do on an average
day? I do business affairs and marketing. You know, like I'd oversee deals, the kind of deals that we had to make, distribution, how we would get paid for records and our distributors and things like that, looking for other kinds of opportunities that we could possibly have. Monica would oversee A&R and creative, mm-hmm. you know, the visuals and stuff like that. So she would bring the stuff in and then I would be involved in the decisions. I was producing some of the stuff in the early days and then I stopped producing. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of that shifted over to her in those days. So I was taking more of a big picture role after a period of time, but also I was running the New Music Seminar.
Right.
So there was 3 or 4 months of the year where it actually moved to a different office and I'd come to Tommy Boy a couple days a week, but 3 days a week I would be in seminar offices. And then I'd be full-time at the Tommy Boy office the rest of the time. And I had another person that was running Dance Music Report, and I kind of had to oversee that. So I was overseeing 3 different businesses at the time.
Yeah.
So Monica had a lot of authority because, you know, I was spread out between a lot of things.
How did tell me a bit about the New Music Seminar, because specifically from a hip-hop point of view, that the battles you had there, both DJ and MC battles, are remembered still. You know, people remember them as iconic. They still talk about them. Sometimes they're recreated on television, as we saw on the breaks a few months ago. How did you get there? How did you get to something that everyone in the culture was paying attention to?
So in 1981, when we did the second New Music Seminar, we had a spinning exhibition and we had a guy named Jeff Breutman illustrating what disco spinning was like and how you blend and, you know, do BPMs and that. And he went first and he was one of the guys that worked at Dance Music Report for me. Mm-hmm. And he also was a DJ. The other guy was the guy who worked cleaning the office with us, and his name was WizKid. And WizKid did a DJ scratching kind of thing, and nobody had really seen that before.
AKA DJ WizKid, was born in the Bronx in 1962 and eventually graduated to working A&R for Tommy Boy and put out his own records on the label, including several well-received songs with Globe. WizKid also went on to win the New Music Seminar's Best DJ Award multiple times in the conference's early years.
It was a packed room of people standing, and they were in the back of the room, and people just went apeshit. And it was all 100% white people into rock and other alternative music that were here at the second seminar. I wouldn't say it's 100%, but it was like 85%. And the conference was really a two-day conference that year, and it was in a club called Privates on 85th and Lex, I think. And just people lost their minds. And after that, we saw the exposure, and all of a sudden, all of the rock critics started writing about this new thing, and people knew about it. You know, audience that was very influential went back to wherever they came from. All of a sudden, they knew about this new kind of scratching and DJing that happened, and they never saw it before, and they really saw it as a new kind of art form. And that was because of the great performance of WizKid that day. And then WizKid went out to make a record for us later on with Globe, play that beat, Mr. DJ. Did a lot of stuff with him.
Yeah. And as it went on, you had the battles, the MC and DJ battles.
The next year we started with the battles, and that was my idea. So I created that, and I thought, you know, wow, let's do something that's like pro wrestling for DJs.
Including with a belt, by the way.
Yeah, I created the belt and worked on the belt and had the idea for that. And I remember, you know, having my assistant go ordering the belt and going down to pick it up, looking for different places that would do wrestling belts. And this was before the internet, so finding all this stuff wasn't so easy. Where do I get a countdown clock, because we used a basketball shot clock use, because they had only 60 seconds they had to use, you know, to do their part and coming up with the rules. And then I put together this group of young people who were very excited about hip-hop, and you know, we had a sort of a hip-hop at that point it was starting to be called hip-hop, we're talking about 82 and 83, and so we had to come up with judges and, you know, how we're going to do that. And it started the first few years it was just DJ. We only added MCing later on,
right?
So I think probably MCing probably started in 84 in the Hilton before we moved to the Marriott Marquis.
One thing that has come up in the past about the New Music Seminar is the theft of the belt.
Melly Mel.
Yeah. So from your perspective, what do you remember about that?
Every time I see Melly Mel, I remind him of that. I say, hey, how you doing? Give back the belt. Oh, that was unbelievable. That was kind of, you know, that this is sort of when hip hop rage started becoming pretty, you know, hip hop was really becoming unbridled at that point, let's say, as a polite word. It was getting more violent. Stetsasonic, I think, performed and they smashed the turntables. It was a tough night. I forget who won the belt that year, but Melly Mel came and took the belt from him. He had already won the belt, I think, in the past. Mm-hmm. And you know, he was like into bodybuilding at the time. And after he took the belt, he put it over his shoulder and did one arm push-ups on the stage, and then he ran out of the club, and the whole audience was chanting, "Give back the belt, give back the belt." It was fantastic.
I was sitting on the corner just a waste of my time when I realized I was the king of the rhyme. I got on the microphone, and what do you see? The rest was my legacy. I was born to be the king.
We got an eyewitness account of this story in our talk with Paradise Gray, and we have to revisit it just because it's so incredible. Melly Mel, who Paradise calls the hip-hop Debo, had won the belt the previous year and showed up at the 1988 New Music Seminar MC Battle with his belt. He challenged that year's winner, Mikey D, essentially to a double or nothing bet. Winner would take both belts home. Mel was actually dressed as a wrestler, and he brought Grandmaster Kaz with him dressed as a ref. Mikey D clearly outrapped Mel, so Melly stopped mid-rhyme and said he was taking both anyway. Kaz picked up both belts and they walked off. They even shoved Big Daddy Kane down the stairs on the way out. Mikey never did get his original belt back, but Tom and the organizers made sure he got a better one. For more on this story, plus KRS-One's own story about a similar run-in with Melly Mel at the Latin Quarter, check out episode 190 with Paradise Gray.
And as the label goes on, right, you become, at least among the artists, somewhat of a public figure and are occasionally mentioned in lyrics and on skits and on things like that. Mm-hmm. De La Soul.
Radio works it, public consumes it, Tommy Boy wants another say no, huh?
And then even a few years afterwards, you had...
The Grave Diggers.
The Grave Diggers, of course.
Yeah, I got one last question. Who killed Tommy's boy?
Well, all people who had been through your doors at some point or another. It was kind of the unifying bond of that group.
All the members of Grave Diggers had some dealings with Tommy Boy. Prince Paul and Fruquan were both members of Stetsasonic, and Paul had also produced De La Soul. Poetic had put out a single on the label back in 1989, and RZA, under the name Prince Rakim, signed to the label in 1991. Monica Lynch, whose name keeps coming up, also shared with us some very early Prince Rakim RZA demos when she came and visited us on episode 171.
GZA, even years after that.
Tommy ain't my motherfucking boy. When your fake moves on a nigga you employ.
Because RZA was on Tommy Boy.
Right, because RZA was on Tommy Boy in his early incarnation. And there was a version of you played by Chris Rock on a Prince Paul album, a sort of character inspired by you.
Sean actually made a mistake here. The Silverman-inspired character on Politics of the Business is actually played by Dave Chappelle, not Chris Rock. We discussed this with Paul in episode 98.
Liked it, schmiked it. It's all backpacking music. You lucky to go double wood with that shit. Double bar doo-doo.
Yo, come on. Yo, Paul, I mean, like,
this ain't the fucking 90s, all right? So why don't you go out there and get some help, some counseling or something, and stop bringing me these fucking whack-ass records and bring me some shit I can sell. It stinks.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny because when I played it for Tom, he's like, he's listening, he's like, ah, ha, ha, ha. And he's like, that kind of sounds like me. I was like, yeah, it's inspired by.
Oh, that was supposed to be me? I still didn't know that.
Yeah, when we had Paul on, he said it was inspired by you. What was it like to hear yourself mentioned on these albums?
I don't know. I think that happens to anybody that gets famous. I mean, Russell's mentioned on records and other, you know, Rick and Russell were always mentioned on records. People always get mentioned on records. And being as used to rejection as I was in my life, it's not really that big of a problem for me, you know. Not everybody can understand everything, you know. The only thing that, you know, you can look back at is you can look at the track record and what are the things that Tommy Boy did that changed the world. Mm-hmm. You know, what did we do that changed the world, and what did I have input on, you know, or was involved in some way to change the world in creating hip hop and building it internationally and, you know, changing the way people made records. And, you know, what people just take for granted now is the normal way things are done weren't normal. They were actually decisions that individuals made at one point. And, you know, we made a lot of decisions. We had, you know, Monica might have talked a little bit about the marketing innovations that we did, so many things that nobody had ever done before and everyone copied. Mm-hmm. Whatever we did. I mean, we did an ad for De La Soul's first album because we wanted to expand it beyond a hip-hop audience to a broader audience because we thought it was deserving of the widest possible audience. So we ran ads in Billboard and two or three other publications. And the Billboard one had a picture of like a white college kid saying, I went in for U2. I came out with De La Soul.
Oh.
And we did one. I went in for the R&B publications that said, I went in for Patti LaBelle. I came out with De La Soul. And we used Queen Latifah's mother as the model, Mrs. Owens. And it was so successful that, and this is poignant now because when Soundgarden was getting ready to break, I think A&M they were on originally, they copied our ad and they ran an ad. I went in for De La Soul. I came out with Soundgarden.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that was how influential we were. We started stickers. The whole idea of stickering back with Stetsasonic. We had a fluorescent sticker, 3-inch by 3-inch, that said STET. That's all it said on it. But it said everything you needed to know. And we put these stickers up everywhere, phone booths, latrines, anywhere you could think of in the right places. And it helped get the word out. Then we did, you know, De La.
Paying for these guys, yeah. Too, right? For
OPP. But it was a 3-inch sticker, a penny a piece, really cheap. And later the stickers got bigger and bigger and more expensive and mumbo jumbo. And then, you know, then it went into like rap cars and then rap vans and then rap garbage trucks. And, you know, and you'd go down 21st Street and there'd be an inch of paper. There'd be wars of people walking back and forth with, you know, placards and things like that, promoting whatever. It just became hyping ourselves. You know, hip hop started to hype itself as the major labels started dumping money into hip hop. And it just drove this crazy. I mean, we also would do sniping, run street ads, or, you know, fly posting around the world. But they would put them up in government property and we would get fines of like $50 per side, you know, for each, because they'd put two next to each other and staple them on. So they'd fine us, you know, two for each one that was up, and there'd be 1,000 up. So we'd have like $20,000 bills with the Dallas Police Department or whatever it was, or New York or wherever. So, you know, we had to come up with other ways. And really it was about innovating. How do we do something people haven't done before?
Right.
And hip hop, you know, in the first, that's why to me the golden age is 79 to 99, because innovation continued through then. Mm-hmm. Maybe it stopped a little earlier than that. Maybe it was, like you said, 95 or 96. But that really explosive era from when it was born until about that time, it was dominated by indie labels until the majors usurped in early 90s. And we had to be innovative because we couldn't throw money at it. As soon as the money came, it was all about Benzes and Beamers. You know, it was a different kind of a thing.
Yeah. Tell me about that change, because you started in the business at a time where it was you guys, it was Def Jam, it was Cold Chillin'. I mean, Def Jam had its CBS relationship.
In 1985, Def Jam Jam signed a distribution deal with CBS. You can hear more about this relationship in our episode 191 interview with former Def Jam employee Faith Newman.
But by and large, independent labels dealing with hip-hop, once it became likely to be profitable enough, you saw majors come in and take over labels, including yours.
Well, no, I went to Warner in 86 and never and started with them in 86, but I owned half of it, and we operated it at arm's length. I distributed myself. You know, we let them put a few albums out and realized that wasn't going to work. We couldn't survive. We had the rights originally just to do the 12 inches through our distribution. Then we started doing everything through our distribution, and that's when we had De La Soul and all of our big hits. They didn't distribute. They weren't on Warner internationally. They were on different labels in different countries. Mm-hmm. Mo Austin let us do whatever we wanted to do to run it. They own half the company. They made half the profits.
Right.
But they didn't do any of the marketing or the distribution, which is very different. With Def Jam, they did their own street marketing, but when it was time to cross a record to pop, they had the CBS team. One of them would, you know, work on their record. We didn't have a team cross records. And I don't think we ever really were able to get Warner's help in crossing records, because when I made the deal, that was one of the real reasons I wanted to do it, because I was only able to go as far as I could go in urban radio. When it came to crossing pop, there was a group of indies, five independent promotion people around the country that had a lock. You couldn't get music played on pop radio unless you paid them.
And they could charge whatever they wanted.
Well, and they did. And they didn't actually do any promotion. All they did was call the record in, and you had to pay the bill on it, because they worked every record.
Right.
Right. And if you didn't work the record, they kept your record off. So that their job really wasn't to break your record. It was to keep it off if you didn't pay them. So it was more like an extortion kind of situation. And it didn't work for us as indies, because our business, we had to make money. We didn't, you know, we weren't in the profit share game like the majors are.
Right.
Our job was to, a hit for us is a record that makes a lot of money, not a record that goes to number one.
Right.
So although it's nice that a record should go to number one if it makes the most amount of money, that wasn't the way it worked.
Yeah.
This was the pre-SoundScan era. SoundScan didn't really start till 92.
Right.
So, you know, at Planet Rock, which was selling 50,000 12 inches a week, never went past number 47 on the top 100 chart. It certainly would have been top three in today's market, if not number one, for sure, at least for a week.
Right.
So, you know, but in those days, they'd call the record stores and pay them, you know, or give them some other kind of gratuity in order to get them to report a record at a certain number. And the majors were hyping the game. They hyped the game at radio. They hyped the game at retail. They hyped the charts. So just because a record was number one doesn't mean it was really number one.
Yeah.
It wasn't based only on sales.
Yeah. So how did majors coming in to the genre change things from where you were sitting?
They destroyed it. I mean, to me, they destroyed hip hop. They took hip hop to another level, which maybe it was good. They made, what they did was they took the DJ out of the hip hop game,
mm-hmm.
because in the 80s, the DJ was always the most important guy. And if you watch The Get Down, maybe that might have been true. It started not being true when you watch The Breaks, mm-hmm. but because that's 1990 already. But before that, you know, it was Eric B. and Rakim. Rakim would come second. You know,
Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All of them was Eric B. and Rakim. You know, it was always, you know, the MC would come second, because the MC wasn't the most important thing. It's Africa Bambaataa and whoever,
right.
you know. So how did that change? Indie labels accepted the artists for who they were and allowed the, you know, the concepts to come from the DJ. The DJ had the musical concept. But the labels then started saying, let's use, you know, this famous producer to work on this record. And they started making these superstar producers. And these producers would charge $10,000 to $50,000 a track.
Yeah.
A track. We didn't spend that for a whole album.
Right.
For the whole thing. Not just to pay the producer.
Yeah.
Then you had to pay for samples on top of that.
Right.
You know, and so it just became very hard to be competitive. You know, you had to find real natural records, like, you know, things like Whoop, There It Is. You know, records that a label could put out and would still sell a million. But soon after that, it became really hard, because it became about the DJ and their provenance, who they were around. Did they come from the Dr. Dre school? Were they under Dr. Dre? What's their legacy? Nobody, in the first 10 or 15 years of hip hop, people weren't judged on their legacy. They were judged only on the record.
Mm.
It was the record dope or not? If it was, great. If it wasn't, next, you know. And I think that's the fair way. But later it started being, oh, you know, this is 50 Cent. You know, he was shot nine times, you know, whatever, we're spending $500,000 on the campaign to break him as an artist. Of course, it's very hard to compete with that.
Right. And one odd little thing in your story is you put out two records at around the same time that both had to do with police and revenge. One in the Chamber and Coffee, Donuts, and Death.
Know who I beat with. Whoever try to endanger, feel this hot one in the chamber.
Stepped up, crept up as I held my breath and then I squeezed.
Coffee, Donuts, and Death. We need backup. The officer down. We need backup. The officer down. Here we go. Show me the backup.
in the 90s. It's just an interesting side note in light of Cop Killer that you kind of put those two out. What was that period like? And what kind of pushback did you get around that stuff? Do you remember?
Tommy Boy had never really done political records or gangster records. We weren't really big into that. We were.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that re-looking through your catalog.
And I just bumped into Steve Rifkin's brother last weekend, who was partners in Loud Records, and they had Wu-Tang and a bunch of other stuff. They were part of the more violent era of hip hop than we were part of. I never really was around that much of it. I mean, we had artists that were angry, like we talked about Daddy-O, and different people would get verbally abusive. And yeah, you know, there's sometimes our artists got pissed off at us, but there wasn't violence. We never had to have police, you know, or any kind of guards in the office, except for a couple of days with Capone and Noriega, who were in that era. And that was the late 90s already. Mm-hmm. And after 1993, we built up our A&R department, and our A&R department started signing what other people were doing. Instead of trying to sign what was next, they were signing what was already happening because they didn't really have a vision. And, you know, we weren't driving the vision as much, Monica and I, as we had been in the past. And also, people weren't coming to us first like they used to, because the majors were paying so much more than what we could pay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. So
that's where some of that stuff came
from.
Yeah.
And the violence was just something that we really weren't involved in. But we tried it with, you know, we had a few things. And Neil Levine did Capone and Noriega with Penalty Records, which was one of our labels that, you know, we were partners in. We also had a little bit, you know, of action trying to do something, you know, we thought maybe we'd have something interesting with, you know, the two that you mentioned. But none of them really responded. You know, Break the Grip of Shame was really the big single that was supposed to launch him, and it didn't do that well.
Enter into a new realm, a new dimension. Pay close attention and witness knowledge.
Break the Grip of Shame, the first single from Paris's debut album, The Devil Made Me Do It, never charted. The title track made it to number 20 on the Hot Rap Singles chart.
And it really didn't seem like people cared that much about. We learned a lot about what people really wanted in hip hop, and really they wanted, you know, records that were addictive and escapist, and that they could party to. Yeah. You know, they wanted great, great party records.
You had more than your share of them. How do you ride the wave of something like an OPP or a Humpty Dance or a Jump Around? Some record that just, at least it seemed to me at the time, unimaginably huge hit.
Yeah, like I know. We were so blessed. You know, we mentioned Planet Rock before, and those records, and even Hip Hop Hooray. And so many other records that we had.
Some of Coolio's hits, yeah.
Yeah, when you have a record that, you know, we get it started, we have to work hard to get it started, but the immediate response is so powerful that it takes on a life of its own, and then you ride it home. Mm-hmm. Those are the records, you know, to me, that make it worth being in the record business. It's right. Not drudgery, it's magic.
Right.
And it's all about the magic for me. And, you know, finding a record that will be magic, it's really hard. You can't force it. It happens or it doesn't happen. The Humpty Dance was the last track recorded. They had turned the album in without it, and we said, we need one more track.
I get stupid. I shoot an arrow like Cupid. I use a word that don't mean nothing, like Luke did. I sang on Do What You Like, and if you missed it, I'm the one who said, just grab them in the biscuits.
That was, it's always that way.
You hear that so many stories like
that. Yeah, exactly.
And you know, other things even like beyond that, when we went to Everlast and did What It's Like later on, you know, there was another miraculous record. That was that and Gangster's Paradise were the two biggest albums that we ever had. Whitey Ford Sings the Blues.
Right.
The two biggest albums in the history of the label. A lot of people don't realize.
Everlast 1998 album Whitey Ford Sings the Blues sold over 2 million copies in the U.S. alone, and he received a Grammy nomination for the album's hit single, What It's Like. Coolio's 1995 album Gangsta's Paradise sold over 3 million in the U.S., and its title track reached number one.
I'm the kind of G the little homies want to be like, on my knees in the night, saying prayers in the streetlight.
Most You knew Queen Latifah very early on. You know, you put out her stuff. Did you have any kind of idea of the kind of star power that she ended up having outside of being a rapper? Were you like, there's something special?
Absolutely. She just had a glow. She had sort of a luminosity that that stars have. And we felt that she was that way right from the beginning. Yeah, that was, you know, she was too young to sign when we first signed her. When we first got her.
Mrs. Owens had to.
Yeah. And then as soon as she became of age, we dealt with her too. You know, we thought she was fantastic. One of my, not regrets, but unhappinesses is that her records didn't sell as much as other records. And I think that that actually is something that you've seen historically. Their female rappers just don't sell as much as male rappers.
Right.
Singers, it's not the same, but in terms of rap, for some reason, you know, females just don't do as well as males do.
Yeah. One of the things that was important for the label's bottom line during a lot of this was compilations. You would do the MTV Party to Go, Jock Jam, stuff like that. How important was that to the health of the label?
It was great. Those records all went close to gold or platinum. Mm-hmm. The MTV Party to Go's raised $12 million for the AMC Cancer Research Foundation, and were still profitable for us and for MTV. And ESPN, Jock Jams were even more profitable than that. And the only reason they died or stopped was when the labels all decided to do the Now compilation and refused to license their music to us or anyone else.
The Now That's What I Call Music series of compilation albums began in the United States in 1998. The series had major record labels directly collaborating to release compilations of recent hits rather than licensing songs to third parties as they had in the past.
That was the instant death. They made a collusive decision not to make their music available for licensing, their pop hits available any other way.
Right.
But we had a great formula there, and Monica was very involved in that as well. You know, we'd go to the Yankee games or the Knick games, and we hear these songs, and we say, wow, what if we, you know, made records like that? And we realized at that point the lesson was the value of recontextualization. Mm-hmm. How do you add new context to old music? And when we put these on halftime shows and we ended up promoting records to the people who decided the records that get played in the timeout periods and things like that in all the sports at all of the arenas and stadiums around the country, we started getting a lot of, it was like working radio, but we didn't have any competition. Nobody else was working these guys. So it was great. And they had huge audiences.
Right.
But we're also dealing with records that already were the records that they knew. So we could use this as a way to really drive some new music, but mostly, you know, to generate a lot of revenue for us and for ESPN at the time. ESPN were our partners in those records, and they donated the free advertising. In exchange, we gave them a piece of the back end, which was much more than what the advertising would have cost, and they would run spots, you know, and it was a gigantic success. We learned the concept of recontextualization because when you hear Rock and Roll Part 2 or We Will Rock You, you know, another, any kind of a record like YMCA. Mm-hmm. These records were on KTEL compilations that sold 30,000 all the time. Every day they'd be on disco compilations and other kinds of compilations that people would put out. But when you made it, when you gave it new context and said, these are the songs you hear at the stadiums, every kid would put it on to pump up before their game in high school and junior high school.
Oh.
And everyone got really into it. And so you changed the context.
Yeah.
So what we learned then is that people don't really buy content, they buy context. So how do you create, and that was the reason why hip-hop couldn't sell just because the record was great anymore. It had to have a story. Okay, there's 50 Cent, or there's Snoop, who's Dre's new find, or, you know, Eminem, who came through that school or whatever, you know, and, you know, even to Drake and, you know, everybody today, you can really see they all came through a legacy of someone before that gave them provenance. That's the same thing as context. They gave context to them as people, and people needed to own them because it was cool to own them. So how do you manage the concept of context in terms of creating music that's successful? It's very, very hard to change context. And we did it with, you'd remember them, they wouldn't just look like everybody else. But then later people just wanted to be real.
Right.
And there was that whole Be Real era where artists just were what they were. And, you know, it was like, are you really a drug dealer? Are you really a killer? You know,
yeah.
And so, you know, that era wasn't really Tommy Boy's best time, unfortunately, yeah. Or fortunately, yeah. Maybe. I'm still here to talk about.
Yeah. And I wanted to jump ahead you know, O2, you end up selling the remaining half of the company to Warner Brothers. Well, what was behind that decision?
They picked up their option. They had the option after a certain amount of years to, I could have bought them or they could have bought me, and the price that it would have cost me to buy them was unobtainable. So they bought our share out, and they let me keep the name going forward. So I started the following Monday independently.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Did they get to dictate the price more or less?
It was fixed in the deal. They paid a multiple of earnings over X percent.
Oh, gotcha. Period. Okay. What was that like to go through for you?
Yeah, you know, it's sad to see the end of an era.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to wind down by asking you about TrackLib. It's an exciting new product around sampling. Can you tell me what it is?
Yeah. TrackLib is a global marketplace where people can discover, acquire, and license old music to use in new recordings, derivative works, we call them. So basically, new producers can acquire and buy tracks, use them in new recordings, know in advance how much it's going to cost and how much they have to give up in the derivative, and they can quick, easy, and affordably do this in maybe less than 5 minutes without a lawyer. So now you can go onto a website and do digital crate digging super fast, 100 to 1,000 times faster than physical crate digging, and scrub through songs to find the get down spot, pull out what you want to use. You know in advance this is going to cost either $100, $2,500, or $500, you know, to license, and that you're going to have to give up whatever it is, somewhere between 10 and 50% of the derivative work on the master and the publishing side in order to obtain those rights. And you know, there's no question, there's no concern, there's no nervousness. It's super fast, super easy, and really affordable for people. And that it's only the purpose to me, the fifth pillar of hip hop was always sampling. Mm-hmm. Whether it was actual sampling the original records like Pete Rock or Prince Paul did,
or like you did with Malcolm X, or very early on,
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah.
The producers did, yeah.
The Keith LeBlanc did, yeah. Yeah.
Malcolm X. No sellout. Malcolm X. No sellout.
Or it was replaying like we did with Jazzy Sensation and Planet Rock, mm-hmm. where there were replays of samples. Either way, the recontextualizing of old music into hip-hop is part of what made hip-hop great. Most of the biggest records in the first 25 years of hip-hop have a sample in them that was known. Mm-hmm. Some of them had samples that weren't known, you know, and by saying weren't known, it's like they hadn't been hits before.
Right.
Prince Paul sort of led in this whole idea of sampling the obscure record rather than sampling the, you know, Mr. Big stuff or something. You know, so I think the ability to be able to acquire those things and those old records and sample them quickly and affordably is going to change the game. And I think sampling, which is art that has been repressed for 35 years, is going to be liberated. And that's why the name of the company's TrackLib is in Track Liberation. And people will be able to sample to their heart's content, and original rights holders and original artists will be fairly compensated, and it will happen automatically, and it will happen in great, great frequency compared to what's happening today. Today, Kanye is the only one who really samples heavily, and everybody else samples infrequently or cheats and just releases records with samples in them and plays
and
the game.
And hopes to get away with it.
And
right.
Gets away with it. And 95% get away with it, so why shouldn't they?
Right.
And the five that don't, when they get caught, they end up paying the same thing they would pay for, which has been what's happened since I started clearing in advance. There were other competitor labels that would just put the record out without clearance and end up paying the same amount once they got busted, if they got busted. So they got to, you know, they got the benefit of cash flow and they got no penalty for cheating. Mm-hmm. But we always thought at Tommy Boy we should do it the right way. And I've always dreamed that there should be something like TrackLib that exists that can make it possible for people who want to use old music to be able to use it. I thought it should be a statutory right, like the right to do a cover record of an old song. Mm-hmm. There's a statutory right. The government gives you that right to do that. Now, as long as the original has been released, you can do it.
Right.
But with samples, that would never happen. I thought naively at one point that maybe there should be a right. We should fight for that. But it would have to happen in every country of the world. Why not have a voluntary system? And now the technology exists where we can do that. And it's a Swedish company, this company called TrackLib. And it's in beta now, and later this year should come out of beta. But it's going to change the game for anybody who wants to sample. And we think once you take the lid off sampling, it's not only going to be hip-hop, pop and electronic and dance that do that, we think that country producers will sample. And, you know, why wouldn't you? Jazz producers will sample. Just think what you could do if you could take a Miles Davis lick and use it on a new record and introduce a whole new audience to Miles Davis or anybody. And it could be a new jazz record. It could be a classical record. It could be any kind of record. So you can take things out of context. And that's when the magic happens. And that's really part of the magic of hip hop. When you think about it, you know, they took these records that were designed to be something else and they used them on a record reaching a different audience that really knew about the original record. And they introduced, I mean, the record I've been listening to and can't get out of my head from the Time of Boy catalog is Stetsasonic Talking All That Jazz, which is about sampling.
About sampling, right.
Well, here's how it started. Heard you on the radio talking about rap, saying all that crap about how we sample. Give an example. Think we'll let you get away with that. You criticize our method of how we make records. You said it wasn't art, so now we're gonna rip you apart.
Stop. Check it out, my man. This is the music of a hip-hop band, jazz.
And it has Alani Liston Smith and the Cosmic Echoes, a sample of Expansions on it. He talks about how jazz artists were very critical of sampling and they thought people should have to play the music themselves. And it was a real problem in those days getting people to understand it. Now people understand it, but the cost of it has been so oppressive that it's impossible, the upfront cost of doing it, that the back end possibilities of splitting revenues with original rights holders has been destroyed practically. And we think that there's a massive marketplace that will be much bigger than what, say, Sync is, like licensing TV, film, and advertising for songs. We think this is going to be much bigger than that, especially in certain genres.
Wow. Well, that sounds very exciting and look forward to hearing more about it when it comes on the market. Tom Silverman, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you so much.
Lots to say, I guess. Thank you.
I've actually interviewed Tom once before for a piece in Forbes about the streaming industry. But even in that very limited context, I couldn't resist talking to him about the label's beginnings and its golden age heyday. I'm really happy I had a chance to deal with those topics in depth this time. I also don't want to undersell his importance in hip-hop. A bunch of people helped bring the genre to larger audiences in its early phases. But without Tom helping Bam and his followers wind up on Wax, and the rest of the Tommy Boy roster, the genre would be nothing like what we know of it today. One of the best things about doing this show for so long is that you have a chance to get different people's perspectives on the same events. Listening to Tom talk about his time running the label, I remembered conversations I'd had on this show with people like Monica Lynch, Prince Paul, and Paris, who went through many of the same things Tom discusses in this episode. And a final note, we know we spent a lot of time talking about Afrika Bambaataa in this episode, who's someone Tom worked closely with. We did not, however, discuss the recent allegations about him, as we wanted to focus on Tom's career, not Bambaataa's. To be totally clear, while Bam's musical and cultural legacy and importance is undeniable, his alleged behavior as a sexual abuser is horrifying. For more about that, you can listen to our interview with a man once so close to Bambaataa that he considered himself an adopted son, the late T.C. Islam, on episode 173. The Cypher will be on our usual summer schedule for July and August, bringing you shows every other week. So join us in 2 weeks on July 17th when our guest will be DJ Toomp. Toomp is a producer best known for his game-changing work with T.I. Together, they helped invent trap music, a sound that went on to take over, well, basically everything. We talk about that, producing for Kanye, some embarrassing outfit choices, and lots more. Oh, and 2 weeks after that, on the 31st, we've got Mr. Boombastic himself, Shaggy. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. That's a good opportunity to check out our back catalog. If you like this episode, you should listen to our talk with one of Tommy Boy's most controversial artists, Paris, on episode 136. Whatever you use to listen to the show, Apple's Podcasts, Google Play, seriously, whatever, go now and give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow to sign up. Bringing you a show every week takes at least 20 hours a week, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just a buck a month, we could at least afford to hit Burger King and their bathrooms while researching and editing.
As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share bonus audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. Join us by the end of June to have access to July's file. Previous months have included unreleased music from the likes of Wu-Tang and Chuck D. If you want to talk to us about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Tataro.
It's really hard. You can't force it. It happens or it doesn't happen.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Rejection, I guess, is really the thing that's driven me all my life.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Was the record dope or not? If it was, great. If it wasn't, next.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
I was in grad school for environmental geology.
Our audio assistant is Rob Van Vranken.
Made me believe in God for the first time.
Our audio consultant is Florence Barrow Adams.
She was the ultimate.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Mike Saunders.
More like an extortion kind of situation.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Did I say anything that contradicted what Monica said?
No, not at all.